lifelong Yukon legacy. Who will replace Klingon? In the hearts and minds of fans, it's not clear that anybody can. On the court, it may be even harder to replace him. On Wednesday, part of Dan Hurley's plan to gear up for a run at an unprecedented modern-era three-peat became clear as Michigan transfer Terrace Reed Jr. announced his commitment to UConn. At 6 feet 10, 265 pounds, he's an athletic, bruising, big, though not quite as imposing as the 7'2", 285-pound Klingon. Though Hurley may not be done portal shopping, his favorite activity, it's clear he believes Reed, who started 31 games for the 8-24 Wolverines last season, is a player who can help UConn stay on top of the college basketball world. The St. Louis native and four-star recruit out of Link Year Academy averaged 9 points and 7.2 rebounds per game as a sophomore last year while shooting 51.9% from the field. So who is Terrace Reed exactly, and what strengths does he bring to UConn? We asked Andrew Kahn, Michigan men's basketball beat writer for the MLLive.com, about his game and how he might fit into plans for the two-time defending champs. By the way, this story is written by Kels Dayton. The interview has been edited for length and clarity, and I will read as much of it as I can. First, the current says, how would you describe Reed's time at Michigan? The coach says, well, to take you back, freshman year, he played 12, 13 minutes a game because they had Hunter Dickinson starting at center. He cleaned up around the basket, was a good rebounder, and played really good defense. He was not a starter, but he was a closer. Head coach Juan Howard always said he'd come in and he'd be a rim protector. He'd switch on to guards and move his feet pretty well. It was promising. I'm going to just move on quickly to these questions. What difference did you see in his game this year as opposed to his freshman year? Kahn says his field goal percentage was about the same, 51.9%. His free throw percentage went away up, though, still not good, 58.6% last season, up from an abysmal 40% his freshman year. Another question from the current, could you see Terrace taking over as UConn's starting center? And Kahn, I want to be clear who Kahn is. He is Michigan men's basketball beat writer, not the coach, as I mentioned before. He's a beat writer for this interview. And I'll repeat that question. Could you see Terrace taking over as UConn's starting center? And Kahn says, yeah, I mean, he's not Klingon. Klingon was amazing defensively. He was all these things I'm talking about, Reed, but just at a higher level. Just great hands, an unbelievable rim protector, and bigger. Reed's not quite 7 feet, but guys typically are transferring with the thought of starting, right? Could he play alongside another big Samson Johnson? He did that with Dickinson, but Dickinson was a shooter. You don't typically want two non-shooters out there. That's not Reed's game. Another question from the current, were you surprised that he ended up transferring to UConn? Kahn says, yeah, certainly, probably some surprise, yeah. Like, okay, he's going to be the two-time defending national champs, going to them, rather. Good for him. But he showed enough flashes. This team went 8-24 last year, so everyone looked worse than they could be. They were bad as a team, so the individual parts didn't look as good. But you take a step back, and it wouldn't be hard to think about some of those guys as a better team thriving. Reed probably played too many minutes, and they probably tried to run too much offense through him, so it hurt him, and it hurt the team. But at UConn, all the pieces are going to be better, you'd think, so it should work out better for him. Another question by the current, as far as his offensive game, you said he's not a shooter. Does he have a mid-range game, or is he just a post player? Kahn says, yeah, it's back to the basket, right near the basket. He would catch it sometimes and face up and get into his jab step and then try to spin off the guy and then back him down. But you can probably count on one hand the number of times he actually took that mid-range shot. It was almost all around the basket. And another question, the current says, how would you describe his personality? We talked to him a fair amount after games, and this year most of them were losses, and he'd still take ownership for himself and the team. He was pretty honest about what was happening. not the most vocal guy, maybe a little soft-spoken, and but his teammates seemed to like him. He talked about religion a lot and his faith, and that helped him through what was a tough season for the team. And finally, the last question the Current asks, do you see him adding anything to UConn, maybe his strengths filling a need that they had keeping this team at a championship level? Khan says it's hard to see that team getting much better, and losing a guy like Klingon, that's not a good thing. Can he step in and give you exactly that production? That's a lot to ask. But yeah, he's a talented player who certainly does some of those things that Klingon gave you, so there's promise there. But yes, he can absolutely be a starter on a very good team. He definitely can. The other pieces matter there too. Of course, he can't be the best player on a national championship team, I don't think, not right now, but there's still definitely room for growth. The school of thought is that bigs sometimes take a little bit longer to develop than guards, so I think the hope is that he's getting better at a higher rate than some other players. We'll tell you what's on the air now. Baseball, quite a lot of Major League games, 6:30 p.m. The Red Sox are at Pittsburgh. Pirates, that's on Nesson, Radio 1080 WTIC. 7 p.m., the Tampa Bay Rays are playing the New York Yankees. That's on YES, Radio 97.9. 7:15, Texas at Atlanta, and that's going to be on Apple TV+. The Mets will be out at the Dodgers. That's going to be a 10 p.m. game, and that will be on SNY, Radio 880, WCBS out of New York. And at 10:15, Arizona at San Francisco, that's on Apple TV. In basketball, NBA Eastern Conference play-in tournament, Chicago at Miami, that's on ESPN. 9:30 p.m. Western Conference play-in tournament, Sacramento at New Orleans. And one golf event, 2 p.m. PGA Tour, the RBC Heritage second round on the Golf Channel. That's it for the sports for today. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, it is Friday, April 19th, 2024. I'm Charlie Shine, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and the New York Times with me today is Bill Murphy. We're going to start by taking a look at the pictures in the front page of the New York Times, and then we're going to go over to Bill and get a look at the pictures in the front page of the Current and get our first story. So, taking a look at the New York Times, we see police on campus. Columbia called in law enforcement yesterday to empty an encampment of pro-Palestinian protesters. And we've got the picture from the campus. We got tents set up, people milling about right on the campus center and right in front of the, looks like, I think that's a library building. I'm not entirely certain. Anyways, we move on down. Right below the fold, we have a woman and her child planting trees in Bogor, Indonesia. Some activists say environmentalism is embedded in the Quran, and we're going to have a closer look at that story in a little bit. By the way, we're also going to be taking a look at the protesters on campus and what that means. A U.S. senator is seeking to ban Chinese electric vehicles. The story, China threatens Biden makeover of the U.S. industry, and the photo is a little bigger than a thumbnail of electric vehicles all piled up. Looks like they're ready for shipment. Then that brings us down to some thumbnail photos in the bottom of the page. We're going to be taking a look at this in our first story in the international section. Deadly rains lash two neighbors. More than 130 people have died in flash flooding and severe weather in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the photo itself is of some folks in, looks like a canoe of some kind, in the middle of a field. As we move on over to the right, "Goodbye Grand Canyon State" is the caption. The Coyotes' 28-year tenure in Arizona has ended. The NHL franchise is off to Salt Lake City, and a picture is two folks sitting in an empty stadium. And then from the Weekend Arts section, a photo from there, "Boundary-Breaking Tapestries." MoMA PS1 is hosting an exhibition of the works of the Navajo weaver Melissa Cody. Above, there's a photo picture of visitors are viewing into the depths she repels. And that's the tapestry that the two folks are looking at, which is, it's hard to tell exactly what we're looking at because, again, it is a thumbnail photo. All right, that's it for the pictures in the front page of the New York Times. And now we're going to take a look at pictures in the front page of the Current. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charlie. I may need your help in pronouncing this thing here. I'm going to try it. When I get to it,
okay.
It's in the caption. It's the circus that I guess is now in Hartford. Is Cirque du Soleil or something like that?
Cirque du Soleil.
Okay, I knew I needed your help with that. All right. the picture is that of an artist. His name is Corey Payne. And he is saying a few words during an unveiling of his new mural on Wednesday at 306 Market Street in Hartford. It says the mural is a project collaborated between Rise Up for Arts and, what is that again, Charlie?
Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil. And then I'm going to tell you what the other picture is, and I'll try to describe them as best I can. Students from the Community First School in Hartford pose for a photo. And they are performers during the unveiling of the mural. And he is standing there, the gentleman, Corey Payne, speaking into a microphone. And behind him are the students, are, I guess, performers. And they're very colorful attire. There's about eight or nine of them standing. Now, I cannot tell you what the mural is. It's a picture of a person with a hat on. I don't know.
It's a person that's wearing some sort of a hat. There are some folks standing in front of the mural. The mural itself is an orange background, and not quite sure who the gentleman is. All right, anyway, we'll turn that back to Bill.
Charlie does a much better job describing than I do, so that's why I gave it to him. All right, we're going to go into the first story. So from the World and Nation section of The Current from Philadelphia, President Joe Biden scooped up endorsements from at least 15 members of the Kennedy political family during a campaign stop Thursday as he aims to undermine former President Donald Trump and marginalize the candidacy of independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Kerry Kennedy, a daughter of former Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, niece of former President John F. Kennedy, and sister of the current presidential candidate, delivered the endorsements in Philadelphia by calling Biden, quote, my hero, unquote. She goes on to say, we want to make a crystal clear announcement that our feeling is that the best way forward for America is to reelect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for four more years. She never directly mentioned her brother, but insisted there are only two candidates with any chance of winning the presidency this year, framing the campaign as a choice between Biden and Trump, with no room for a third-party contender. Biden, who keeps a bust of Robert F. Kennedy in the Oval Office, said the endorsements were, and this is a quote from the president, an incredible honor. He said Trump, the former president, who was the presumptive Republican nominee, was a threat to America's democratic traditions, and that now it's time to keep going and not slow down because there's so much at stake. The decision to highlight the Kennedy family support more than 6 months from Election Day is an indication of how seriously Biden's team is taking a long-shot candidate using his last name's lingering Democratic magic to siphon support from the incumbent. Kennedy Jr. played down the endorsements, writing on social media that his family was, quote, divided in our opinions, but united in our love for each other. And he said his campaign was about healing America. That was a quote. Given Kennedy Jr.'s quixotic political positions and the expectation this year's campaign will be decided by thin margins, both Democrats and Republicans worry that he could play the role of spoiler. Back to you, Charlie.
Deadly rains pound Afghanistan and Pakistan well ahead of monsoons. A deluge of unseasonably heavy rains has lashed Pakistan and Afghanistan in recent days, killing more than 130 people across both countries, with the authorities forecasting more flooding and rainfall, and some experts pointing to climate change as the cause. In Afghanistan, at least 70 people have been killed in flash floods and other weather-related incidents, while more than 2,600 homes have been destroyed or damaged, according to Mullah Janan Sayo, a spokesman for the Ministry of Disaster Management. At least 62 people have died in the storms in neighboring Pakistan, which has been hammered by rainfall, at least twice the average rate for this time this year, according to Pakistani officials. Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, the Pakistani region bordering Afghanistan, appears to be the hardest hit. Flash floods and landslides caused by torrential rains have damaged homes and destroyed infrastructure. Photos and videos from the province show roads turned into raging rivers and homes and bridges being swept away. The rains have caused significant damage, said Billy Fazi, spokesperson for the Provincial Disaster Management Authority, said in a phone interview. He added that at least 33 people had died in the province over the past 4 days, and 336 houses had been destroyed. Around midnight on Monday, in Swat Valley, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, Akbarzada woke up to a thunderous crash after a boulder tumbled down a nearby mountain in the rain and destroyed a room of his home, where two of his sons were sleeping. The boys, 14 and 16, were both killed. The rain has been relentless these years, and now it's taken my sons, Mr. Zada said in a phone interview. The deluge in Afghanistan and Pakistan began at the same time the rainstorm swept the Gulf, battering the United Arab Emirates and Oman with a record-setting rainfall that killed at least 20 people in both countries. The storms in the United Arab Emirates constituted the largest rainfall event in the region in 75 years. In Pakistan, the recent flooding comes just over 2 years after a devastating monsoon season battered the country in 2022, killing over 1,700 people and affecting about 33 million more. That flooding destroyed millions of acres of crops, caused billions of dollars worth of damage, and started an international conversation about the environmental costs of global warming that poorer countries disproportionately shoulder, Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. Another story from the World and Nation section of The Current. This is from Washington. House congressional leaders were toiling Thursday on a delicate bipartisan push toward weekend votes to approve a $95 billion package of foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, as well as several other national security policies at a critical moment at home and abroad. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson this week set in motion a plan to advance the package, which has been held up since October by GOP lawmakers resistant to approving more funding for Ukraine's fight against Russia. As the Republican Speaker faced a rebellion from his right flank and growing threats for his ouster, it became clear that House Democrat Leader Hakeem Jeffries would have to lead and lend a help to Johnson every step of the way. This is a very important message we're going to send to the world this week, and I'm anxious to get it done, Johnson said Wednesday, announcing his strategy. The growing momentum for a bipartisanship dynamic, a rarity in the deeply divided Congress, brought rare scenes of Republicans and Democrats working together to assert U.S. standing on the global stage and help American allies. But it also sent Johnson's House Republican majority into fresh rounds of chaos, Johnson's Republican leadership team seizing on the opportunity to outflank hardline conservatives with Democratic support, raised the idea of quickly changing the procedural rules to make it harder to oust the speaker from office. but ultra-conservatives reacted with fury, angrily confronting Johnson on the House floor in a tense scene Thursday morning. Several suggested they would join the effort to oust Johnson if the rule was changed. By the afternoon, Johnson backed away from the idea. "We will continue to govern under the existing rules," the speaker said on the social platform X, formerly Twitter. Meanwhile, a rare image of bipartisan statesmanship was on display as the Procedural Rules Committee began debate, launching the steps needed to push the foreign aid package forward toward weekend voting. The Republican chairman of the powerful Appropriations and Foreign Affairs Committees, alongside their top Democratic counterparts, spoke in evocative language, some drawing on World War II history, to make the case for ensuring the U.S. stand with its allies against aggressors. Charlie?
Prince Harry, officially a U.S. resident, filing says. From London. The document filed on Wednesday at Britain's corporate registrar Companies House was just a few lines long, but its purpose was to formally update the country of residency for one, quote, Prince Harry Charles Albert David Duke of Sussex, otherwise known as Prince Harry. For years, Harry and his American wife, Meghan, have considered California home. The document updated the residency of the British royal to the United States for official paperwork for his business, Travelist Limited, a nonprofit sustainable travel initiative. The paperwork was just a bureaucratic formality, but it underscores just how far Harry, 39, has come from his days as a central member of the royal family to the country of his birth to a very different life with his wife and children in California. It also comes at a time of turmoil for the House of Windsor. Harry and Meghan moved to Montecito, California, after stepping back from royal duties in 2020 amid a rift with the royal family. Prince Harry said in February that he had considered becoming a U.S. citizen, telling ABC's Good Morning America, "It's a thought that's crossed my mind, but it's not a high priority for me right now." But there had been little in the way of official confirmation of Harry's residency status until this week. The filing indicates the change in residency dates back to June 29, 2023, the day that Buckingham Palace confirmed the couple had vacated Frogmore Cottage, their British home. Queen Elizabeth II had offered the home to the couple when they were married in 2018. It's unclear what type of U.S. visa or residency permit Harry holds, despite efforts by conservative activists in the United States to ascertain them, including a current lawsuit. He could be eligible for a green card through his marriage to Meghan, a U.S. citizen. Immigration lawyers have pointed out that he could also be entitled to A1 diplomatic visa available to members of a reigning royal family. The Heritage Foundation, a conservative research institute, launched a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security in June 2023 to see documents related to Harry's visa, saying the group had a right to see them as part of research data into whether his application for residency should have been rejected because of past drug use. Harry, the fifth in line of succession to the British throne, wrote in Spare, his 2023 memoir, that he had used cocaine and other drugs in the past. Last month, former President Donald J. Trump told the right-wing British broadcaster GB News that he would take, quote, appropriate action, unquote, if Harry were to have found to have lied on a visa application. The Heritage Foundation had sought the documents specifically to investigate how the prince had been admitted, since some visas require applicants to answer questions about past drug use and legal violations. The Department of Homeland Security declined to make those documents public when they were requested last year, stating that there had been no public interest in disclosure sufficient to override the subject's privacy interests. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. And one more story from the World and Nation section of The Current, again from Washington. The U.S. and U.K. on Thursday imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran as concern grows that Tehran's unprecedented attack on Israel could fuel a wider war in the Middle East. The sanctions are meant to hold Iran accountable for its weekend attack and to deter further such activity. But the practical impact is likely to be limited because many of the targeted companies already were subject to U.S. sanctions, and the individuals singled out for new sanctions are unlikely to have assets in U.S. jurisdictions. Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control targeted 16 people and two entities in Iran that produce engines that power the drones used in the April 13th attack on Israel. OFAC also sanctioned five firms involved in steel production and three subsidiaries of Iranian automaker Bahman Group, which is accused of materially supporting Iran's military and other sanctioned groups. A representative from Bahman was not immediately available for comment. Additionally, the UK targeted several Iranian military branches and individuals involved in Iran's drone and ballistic missile industries. President Joe Biden said in a statement that he had directed the U.S. Treasury, this is a quote, to continue to impose sanctions that further degrade Iran's military industries, unquote. He does go on to say, let it be clear, all those who enable or support Iran's attacks, we will not hesitate to take all necessary action to hold you accountable. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said in a statement that the sanctions will further limit Iran's ability to destabilize the region. In addition, the U.S. Commerce Department is imposing new controls to restrict Iran's access to commercial-grade microelectronics, which applies to items manufactured outside the U.S. that are produced using U.S. technology. The actions come after U.S. officials earlier this week warned that they were readying new sanctions in response to Iran's activity in the region and to prevent future attacks. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill also have been quickly pushing forward legislation that would financially punish the Islamic Republic and its leaders. It's approximately 19 minutes after the top of the hour. That means it's time for the weather. Charlie's going to give us a national forecast from the New York Times, and then I will give you the local forecast.
The national forecast from the New York Times. Spotty afternoon thunderstorms will bring damaging wind gusts to South Carolina, northeastern Georgia, and North Carolina today. However, widespread severe weather is not expected. Farther north, showers will dampen much of the northeast. The exception will be coastal New England, where a dry day is likely. A steadier rain around the eastern Great Lakes will come to an end in the afternoon. Afternoon rain will develop in eastern Colorado. Rain will mix with and change to snow overnight in the same area. A few afternoon thunderstorms will develop in the Sierra Nevada. Winter will linger in northern North Dakota and northern Minnesota, where snow flurries are expected. Temperatures above freezing will preclude any accumulation.
Hi, this is Beth Bradley, inviting you to join us weekday afternoons at 3 or anytime online and on demand for USA Today on Chris.
The forecast for this evening is rainy with a low around 45. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, high near 65. Tomorrow evening will also be mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming clear, with a low around 37. Mostly sunny on Sunday, with a high near 61. Sunday evening looks to be mostly clear, with a low around 37. And Monday will be sunny, with a high near 63. Monday evening looks clear, with a low around 35. Have a great evening, and thanks for listening to Chris.
Continuing with the New York Times, the front page, colleges warn of punishment for disruptions, setting limits on Gaza as protests spread. The 100-year-old annual honors convocation at the University of Michigan is a typically decorous affair with a pipe organ accompanying golf clap applause. This year's event was anything but. Protesters rose from their seats and unfurled banners with Free Palestine written in red paint. They shouted, "You are funding genocide." Unable to continue with the ceremony, university officials cut it short as hundreds of disappointed students and their parents stood up and walked out. 2 days after the honors convocation, the university's president, Santa J. Ono, issued a stern rebuke. "Enough. Like many of you, I am proud of our university's history of protest," he said, "but none of us should be proud of what happened on Sunday." He announced that the school would draft a new policy to redefine what could be punished as disruptive behavior. The University of Michigan is not alone. After years of loose enforcement of their own rules, some of the country's most high-profile academic institutions are getting bolder, suspending and in some cases expelling students. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, New York University, and Brown University have recently taken swift and decisive action against student protesters, including making arrests. And on Thursday, Columbia University hit its limit with student protesters who had set up dozens of tents on campus, sending in the New York Police Department to make arrests. The arrest followed congressional testimony on Wednesday, in which the president of Columbia, Nima Shafiq, said that the school had delivered an unambiguous message to students that misconduct would not be tolerated. College officials are driven by criticism from alumni, donors, and Republican lawmakers, but in interviews, they also described a gnawing sense that civility on campus has broken down. They say that lately some student protests have become so disruptive that they are not only interfering with their ability to provide an education, but they also have left many students, particularly Jewish ones, fearing for their safety. Recalibrating isn't necessarily easy, as many universities are learning. Efforts by administrators to claw back some of their authority over campus demonstrations are being met with pushback from students, faculty, and civil liberties groups who say that a university's role is to foster debate, even if it's messy, rude, and disruptive, and not attempt to smother it. Campus activists said that the aggressive enforcement of the student disciplinary process by universities is new and concerning development. This is an escalation, said Roy Fitzgerald of the Institute of Middle East Understanding, a nonprofit that is tracking how schools are responding to student demonstrations. Suspensions and expulsions didn't used to be a tactic, she said, but now we're seeing that is an immediate response. In her congressional testimony, Dr. Shafiq revealed that 15 Columbia students had been suspended in recent weeks. She also said that the school had made the decision to ask the NYPD to assist with protest. Vanderbilt University issued what are believed to be the first student expulsions over protests related to the Israel-Hamas conflict. More than two dozen demonstrators stormed the university president's office, injuring a security guard and shattering a window, and occupied it for more than 20 hours. Vanderbilt suspended every student involved in the demonstration. Three were expelled. Student protests have a history of being disruptive and occasionally violent, from the Vietnam War era to today. Since Donald J. Trump's election in 2016, many campuses have become especially volatile places, seeing an increase in angry demonstrations over conservative speakers, some of whom have been disinvited out of fear for their safety. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of the Hartford Courant, nearly 4 hours into her termination hearing earlier this week, the Oversight Commission, considering the removal of Chief Public Defender Tashawn Bowden Lewis, asked her lawyer whether he wanted to continue until late at night or recess and reconvene another time. "You want to stay here until 10? Attorney Thomas Bucci whispered to Bowden Lewis, though not softly enough to avoid being caught by a microphone. "We'll have to keep you on the payroll as long as possible." Bowden Lewis, who has been suspended with pay, laughed and replied, "Yes, I know, I know." By Thursday, she had decided to cut the process short, informing the Public Defender Services Commission, with which she has been at odds with for the entirety of her time in office, that she has decided against calling witnesses in her defense. Attorney Bucci has confirmed that he will be proceeding directly to an oral summation without additional witness testimony, Commission Chairman Richard N. Palmer said Thursday. The commission will schedule a special public hearing for the purpose of hearing attorneys Bucci's summation and commencing deliberations in the near future. The date of the special public hearing will be announced on the Division of Public Defender Services website as soon as it is scheduled. Bowden Lewis' decision not to call witnesses to rebut the commission list of charges against her moves the state's public defender service closer to some sort of resolution of her tumultuous 2-year battle with successive oversight commission. Charlie?
Muslims heed a sacred duty to the sun and soil from Jakarta, Indonesia. The faithful gathered in an imposing modernist building, thousands of men in skull caps and women in veils sitting shoulder to shoulder. Their leader took to his perch and delivered a stark warning. Our fatal shortcomings as human beings have been that we treat the earth as just an object, Grand Imam Nusrata Umar said. The greedier we are towards nature, the sooner doomsday will arrive. He then prescribed the cure as laid out by their faith, which guides almost a quarter of humanity. Like fasting during Ramadan, it is every Muslim's fard al-ayn or obligation to be a guardian of the earth. Like giving alms, his congregants should give waqaf, a kind of religious donation to renewable energy, like daily prayers, planting trees should be a habit. The environment is a central theme in the sermons of Mr. Nasruddin, the influential head of the mosque in Jakarta, Indonesia, who has tried to lead by example. Dismayed by the trash sullying the river and the mosque's the mosque sits on, he ordered cleanup. Shocked by astronomical utility bills, he retrofitted Southeast Asia's largest mosque with solar panels, slow-flow faucets, and a water recycling system, changes that helped make it the first place of worship to win a green building accolade from the World Bank. The Grand Imam says he is simply following the Prophet Muhammad's instructions that Muslims should care about nature. He's not alone in this country of more than 200 million people. The majority of the Muslims is trying to kindle environmental awakening through Islam. Top clergy have issued fatwas or edicts on how to rein in climate change. Neighborhood activists are beseeching friends, family, and neighbors that environmentalism is embedded in the Quran. As a country with the largest number of Muslim people in the world, we have to set a good example for Muslim society, Grand Imam Nusrudin said in an interview. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of The Current, the University of Connecticut is close to reaching an agreement to convert commercial space in downtown into housing for 200 students to serve its regional campus in the city. We are about 95% complete on a term sheet, Robert Corbett, UConn's Interim Associate Vice President for Planning, Design, and Construction, recently told a Board of Trustees committee, according to a video of the meeting. The developer is still slightly short, about $3 million short of making the full transaction complete. Corbett did not identify the Hartford building or the developer, but the leading candidate is the 8-story office building at the corner of Pratt and Trumbull Streets across from the XL Center. A term sheet outlines the financing of a development and other conditions of the project. Ever since UConn opened its regional campus in downtown Hartford in 2017, there has been discussion about the addition of undergraduate student housing, something the university has successfully done at its Stanford campus. Corbett told the trustees' Building, Grounds, and Environment Committee that the residence hall could be open as soon as the fall of 2025, but no later than the fall of 2026. A university spokeswoman declined to comment on the potential location of the downtown Hartford housing or other details, including what the project might cost. Corbett said the city of Hartford is looking to commit funds to the project, and the developer has increased its equity investment. Some philanthropic fundraising also may be necessary for operations, said Corbett.
And now we continue with the national section of the New York Times, the right destination for blue conservatives. Influx turns deep red South Carolina into the nation's fastest growing state. From Greenville, South Carolina, Jen Hubel became a real estate agent in Greenville, South Carolina, because she believed a good life started with a good home. And now her phone buzzed regularly with calls from out-of-state clients who believed they could find both things in her city. Many were staunch conservatives from deeply blue states like New York, Washington, and California, fed up with the politics there. Could Ms. Hubel, a conservative herself, help them find neighborhoods of like-minded people? Her response was always emphatic. You're going to love it here. Ms. Hubel is the lead agent in South Carolina for Conservative Move, a Texas-based company that helps conservative migrate to solidly red places. When your community no longer reflects morals and values, it might be time to move, its website says. And with South Carolina surpassing Florida last year as the fastest-growing state in the country, she's keeping very busy. The in-migration has fueled a years-long real estate boom across South Carolina, where Republicans have controlled the governor's mansion and legislature for more than two decades. Real estate agents like Ms. Hubble say many of their clients are religious conservatives whose reasons for moving include opposition to policies like abortion access, support for transgender rights, and vaccine mandates during the pandemic. Paul Chabot, the founder and president of Conservative Move, which works with about 500 agents across the country, said that when he started his company in 2017, there were not a lot of people asking to go to South Carolina. In the last 2 years, however, it's joined Texas and Florida among the top three states that the company's clients are buying homes in, Mr. Chabot said. About 5,000 people in its clientele database have expressed interest in moving to South Carolina soon. Most of the company's clients in South Carolina have chosen to buy houses in Greenville County, which is a deeply conservative and Christian region known as the Upstate. The county had the second largest population growth in the state from 2020 to 2022, behind Horry County, which encompasses Myrtle Beach and has more expensive houses. Ms. Hubble, along with half a dozen other real estate agents who did not work with Conservative Move, but whose experiences mirrored hers, describe having had an easy time selling the appeal of Greenville. That was especially true with clients moving from large liberal cities and their outskirts who still want a hint of cosmopolitan life. Greenville is big enough for Broadway shows and rooftop bars, but people still often see their neighbors downtown, where a pedestrian bridge gives an overhead view of the Reedy River Falls. Agents often point out the lack of homeless encampments in the city. Perhaps the most important, property taxes are low and houses are generally less expensive than out west or in New England. The median price for a house is about $360,000. Real estate agents will also note that there are hundreds of churches near Greenville, mostly Christian. Also, Bob Jones University, a prominent evangelical school, is here. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. The rest of our stories from The Current will come from the Connecticut section. Two people are dead, and a third is in critical condition following a fire at a multifamily home in Wallingford on Wednesday that police say is, quote, criminal in nature, unquote. Fire broke out Wednesday around 6 p.m. at a home located at 25 Geneva Avenue, where crews responded after receiving a 911 call from someone who reported hearing screaming from inside the home, according to the Wallingford Fire Department. Police and fire crews responded and quickly located a man outside who was suffering from serious burns, according to police. He was airlifted via LifeSAR to an area burn center and remains in critical condition, police said. Fire crews entered the home and found two people inside the second floor apartment, according to police. One was pronounced dead at the scene and the other was taken to an area hospital where they were pronounced dead, police said. The victims have not been identified. Department Fire Chief Samuel Wilson told news reporters late Wednesday that rescue crews had to contend with heavy black smoke and heat while searching for victims. It was not immediately clear how many people resided in the house or how many were home when the blaze broke out. The American Red Cross is assisting those who were displaced. The fire is being investigated by the state fire marshal and the Wallingford fire marshal with assistance from the police department's investigative services division, Connecticut State Police Central District Major Crime, and the New Haven State's Attorney Office. Wallingford Police Chief John Ventura said in a statement Thursday that the investigation into the fire, again a quote here, indicates that the incident is criminal in nature. Unquote. He said investigators could not release any additional details. The investigation has been assigned to the Wallingford Investigative Services Division. Anyone with information has been asked to call the Wallingford Police Department at 203-294-2845. Information can also be left at the department's website at police.wallingford.gov. Charlie?
Okay. Biden wields policymaking power in appeal to key voters. From Washington, last Monday, it was forgiving student loans. This week, it was calling for tariffs on Chinese steel. Soon, President Biden is expected to protect federal land in the Alaskan wilderness. As his re-election campaign heats up, Mr. Biden is leaning heavily on the powers of the presidency to try to shore up his support among key constituencies, young people, union workers, and environmentalists, many of whom have expressed disappointment in his handling of the issues they care about. It is a tactic often employed by previous sitting presidents, but one that's made more urgent for Mr. Biden by polls that show lagging support among several of the groups that helped him win 4 years ago. Campaign aides say that the rapid-fire string of announcements, which will continue, demonstrate that the president hears their concerns. It is also part of the campaign's broader strategy of trying to boil down the choice for voters to a simple one of governing versus chaos. The announcements by Mr. Biden are meant to draw a contrast with former President Donald J. Trump, who spent most of this week sitting at the defendant's table during the first of his four criminal trials. You've got a president who's bringing people together to get things done, like relieve student loan debt, protect American manufacturing, and lead on the world stage, while Donald Trump screams into an echo chamber of MAGA extremism on Truth Social, said Michael Tyler, the communications director for Mr. Biden's reelection campaign. Republicans view the president's spate of policy announcements as an effort to distract from what they consider the real issues of the campaign: immigration, inflation, taxes, and what they insist is a weak foreign policy that's encouraged the country's adversaries to act out. In a statement, Mr. Trump's campaign called Mr. Biden a globalist shill for China and contended he made life worse, not better, for workers and families. Biden's latest policy announcements are nothing more than last-minute attempts to save face with demographics of voters that he's bleeding support from 6 months ahead of the election, said Caroline Leavitt, the national press secretary of the former president's campaign. Democrats are also focusing on issues with broader resonance, especially abortion rights, democracy. Although the president's recent events have helped to focus attention on his promises to key constituencies, the gears of government often crank slowly, and it's far from clear that the targeted policy actions will take effect in time to help his campaign assuage his voters' concerns. The new student loan regulations that the president announced will not be finalized until just weeks before Election Day, and even then, they are likely to be blocked by legal challenges that could last months or years. His proposed steel tariffs on China could take years to fully affect the U.S. market and would address only a small element of the intensifying economic challenge from Beijing. And the action in Alaska is just one small part of the numerous government actions that environmentalists say are needed to protect the planet. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. Eyebrow raising comes to mind when you first visit Dudleytown Brewing Company in Windsor. Far from a hole-in-the-wall dive, Dudleytown greets you with a large outdoor patio and a spacious industrial vibe. Wooden banisters draped in lights hang from the ceiling. Brewing equipment is showcased behind a glass enclosure for curious guests to watch the magic happen. There are plenty of seats for parties, with additional room in the back for events, not to mention the massive deck in the back overlooking a spread of baseball fields to catch a game if you're lucky. For owners and brewers Jonathan Levine and Daryl Dunlap, however, their first brew was made in a much smaller location. "So behind my house I have a barn that I built," said Dunlap. "We built out the entire interior of the barn and really created a special place that was like an inspiration room for us." Their first ever brew came in 2017 on a half-barrel pilot system. It was not long until they had a name too, Dudleytown. "I had no clue what Dudleytown was," said Dunlap. "It's actually a ghost town that's out in the western part of the state, in like the Cornwall area. Something that represented Connecticut that people knew and Connecticut would remember," said Levine. "Their beer names reflect their fun choice in branding, whether it is their staple IPA called Ghost or other delicious options like Crypt Passion of the Geest or Dark Entry. In time, they were attending beer festivals and planning out a more permanent location. Windsor was their first choice, and they found a location that would work, only for COVID to grind everything to a halt. Going into 2020, COVID hit, and it put the project on a back burner, said Dunlap. I didn't know if we'd even get this project off the ground. Thankfully came 2021 and things got back on track. Both Dunlap and Levine worked with the same property owner from before the pandemic, finding investors while planning out designs for how the space would look. They worked with an architect to meticulously customize every inch of space, drawing on past travels and inspirations. The next challenge was scaling up their brews. Scaling up a recipe from, you know, a half-barrel system to 15 barrels, which we have now, is completely different, said Levine. We brought on a head brewer here to help us do that. It is thanks in large part to Robert Lawrence, the current head brewer of Dudleytown, that Dunlap and Levine managed to bring their recipes up in scale while keeping their distinct mouth, feel, and taste. As Levine puts it, when we were originally opening up, we said, you know, if we could have three things, great beer, a great atmosphere, and great service, we're going to knock it out of the park. Robert bought that great beer aspect. Charlie?
In a Manhattan criminal court, a jury is picked to judge a president. At 4:30 p.m. yesterday, 12 citizens were selected to decide the guilt or innocence of a former president for the first time in American history, a moment that could shape the nation's political and legal landscapes for generations to come. The dozen New Yorkers will sit in judgment of Donald J. Trump, the 45th president turned criminal defendant who's been accused of falsifying records to cover up a sex scandal. If the jurors convict Mr. Trump, he could face up to 4 years in prison, even as he seeks to reclaim the White House as the presumptive Republican nominee. We have our jury, Justice Juan M. Merchan proclaimed as the 12th juror was added. He then swore the seven men and five women to an oath that they would render a fair and impartial verdict, which they accepted with sober expressions as Mr. Trump stared from the defense table. As the jurors left the courtroom, Mr. Trump leaned on his elbows at the defense table, staring at the citizens who will decide his future. The jurors could hear opening arguments as soon as Monday. The selection of the 12 capped a seesaw day in which the judge first excused two people who'd been seated earlier in the week, and then hours later, replaced them with two new faces and more. The moment was both routine and never before seen, an act performed every day in courthouses around the country, but never before a former president, a symbol and source of the nation's political divide. Mr. Trump, under the Constitution, is entitled to a fair trial by a jury of his peers, and yet, in some ways, he is peerless, a singular force in American politics, who was twice impeached and brought democracy to the brink when he refused to accept his election defeat. Now, just as he bent the political world to his will, Mr. Trump is testing the limits of the American justice system, assailing the integrity of jury and judge alike. His attacks have emboldened his base and might well resonate more broadly on the campaign trail. But it will be the 12 men and women of the jury in Mr. Trump's hometown who will first decide his fate before millions more to do so at the polls. It's now 45 minutes after the hour. That means it's time for a break, and Bill and I will be back right after this.
People with diabetes can develop many different foot problems, so being proactive in protecting your feet can go a long way in avoiding any serious complications. Here are some foot care tips from the American Diabetes Association. Check your feet daily for sores, cuts, cracks, blisters, or redness. Use a mirror to see all of your foot. Wear socks. Try to choose socks that have some padding if you need more cushion on the bottom of your feet, are made of a synthetic fabric or wool to wick away any moisture, fit well and aren't too tight, and are white or light colored to make it easy to spot any bleeding or drainage. Get fitted for the right footwear and wear shoes indoors and out. Don't put shoes on without socks. In warmer months, refrain from going barefoot, wearing flip-flops, or open shoes. Ask your provider about compression socks or stockings. Wash your feet with warm, not hot, soapy water and be sure to dry between your toes. Keep toenails trimmed. When buying diabetes-related foot products, look for the American Podiatrist Medical Association, APMA, seal of approval, which means they promote good foot health. keep up with regular foot care visits and exams, and be sure your health care providers are on the same page. This message was brought to you by the American Diabetes Association in cooperation with Chris, Connecticut's talking newsstand.
And we're back with the national section of the New York Times. Elections become more accessible to disabled voters, but gaps remain. In 2018, Kenia Flores, who's blind, voted by mail in North Carolina because she was attending college out of state. Had she been able to vote in person, she could have used an accessible machine. But voting absentee, her only option, was to tell another person her choices and have them fill in her ballot. She had no way to verify what they did. Desana Cosma, who uses a wheelchair, arrived at her precinct in Michigan that year to find that all the voting booths were standing height. A poll worker suggested she complete her ballot at the check-in table and got annoyed when Ms. Cosma said that she had a right to complete it privately. Another worker intervened and found a private space. That night, Ms. Cosma, the executive director of Detroit's Disability Power, where Ms. Flores is a voting access and election protection fellow, vented to the group's advisory committee and discovered that every one of them had a story about lack of ability to vote easily, and we all had different disabilities. She said it made me realize, oh, wow, even more than I realized, this is a significant problem. It has been for decades. A series of laws, including the Help America Vote Act in 2002, or HAVA, which created new standards for election administration and grant programs for states to maintain those standards, have sought to make it easier. And they have, but major gaps remain. That is illustrated in a new report to the Federal Election Assistance Commission released Thursday by six researchers from Rutgers University and one from San Diego State University. The report provided to the New York Times looked at the elections through the 20th anniversary of HAVA in 2022 and found that the law had generally improved accessibility. The shift was reflected in both quantitatively in turnout and percentage of people reported trouble voting and quantitatively in voters' responses in the focus group. But while the group, while the gap has shrunk, disabled Americans still vote at a much lower rate in America than Americans who aren't disabled. In 2000, the last pre-HAVA election, turnout for people with disabilities was nearly 17 percentage points lower than the rate for people without disabilities. And by 2020, the most recent election that's directly comparable since presidential and midterm years of different characteristics, that had narrowed to about 11 points. The gap has always been smaller in midterms. Those electorates tend to consist of fewer and more dedicated voters. In 2022, it was 4.6 points, which was lower than the last midterm. A separate measure, that percentage of people reported difficulty voting, even if they managed it, showed that significant progress over the last 10 years. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. Despite passionate pleas from parents, teachers, and officials, Hartford School Board passed a $429 million budget on Tuesday that slashes hundreds of positions and services from the city's education system. The district, which faced a $77 million budget deficit earlier this year, already cut $40.9 million in current spending and mitigated $32.5 million to close the gap, according to budget documents. The $429 million budget passed on a unanimous vote by the Board of Education. Tonight, you are being asked to vote on a budget that is insufficient to meet the needs of our students, said Carol Gale, president of the Hartford Federation of Teachers, during public comments at the Board of Education meeting on Tuesday. This budget represents higher class sizes, less student choices and electives, the elimination of classroom paraeducators, the already inadequate number of art, music, and library teachers cut further in half, and less support for family engagement, student mental health, and behavioral challenges in the classroom. But despite objections, district leaders said there was no choice but to make drastic cuts to get rising expenditures, $467.7 million, in line with fixed revenues, $429.4 million. The budget challenge, officials said, is plaguing school districts and cities across the country as education costs soar and COVID-era federal funds disappear. I understand that the 2024-2025 school year will be a challenging one as we adapt to changes across our schools as a result of these difficult financial decisions. However, I am confident in our ability to continue to provide our students with high-quality instruction and engaging opportunities to help them succeed in school and in life, Superintendent Dr. Leslie Torres Rodriguez said in a statement. And back to Charlie.
Weight loss drug helps relieve sleep apnea, Eli Lilly reports, citing its studies. The pharmaceutical manufacturer Eli Lilly announced on Wednesday that its obesity drug tirzepatide, or Zepbound, provided considerable relief to overweight or obese people who had obstructive sleep apnea or episodes of stopped breathing during sleep. The results from a pair of year-long clinical trials could offer a new treatment option for some 20 million Americans who have been diagnosed with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea.